Today is Thursday, April 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, French President Emmanuel Macron's speech to Congress underscores policy differences with his American counterpart.
Isolationism, withdrawal, and nationalism. This is an option. It can be tempting to us as a temporary remedy to our fears. But closing the door to the word will not stop the evolution of the word.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments in President Trump's travel ban. Guarded optimism ahead of a historic inter-Korea summit Friday. Also ahead, a press freedom watchdog group pushes the United States down a few notches. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, French President Emmanuel Macron wrapped up an official state visit Wednesday with remarks to a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, urging lawmakers to work to ensure the U.S. does not abandon the Iran nuclear deal.
But it is true to say that this agreement may not address all concerns, and very important concerns. This is true. But we should not abandon it without having something substantial and more substantial instead. That's my position.
And the French leader urged lawmakers to take climate change seriously.
I believe in building a better future for our children, which requires offering them a planet that is still habitable in 25 years.
Well, joining us now to sum up the entire visit is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, we saw a lot of kissing and hand-holding between President Trump and Emmanuel Macron, but his speech to Congress showed the stark differences they have.
It was indeed an interesting turn. That day when President Macron was at the White House, we had the French seduction, the kisses, the hugs, the handshakes, the great friendship. And this speech to the Congress, though, this will really play well with the French people because France loves grandeur. It loves the idea that France is part of the international order. And that was one of the key points that President Macron made in his address, was that these international organizations that were set up to prevent another world war, NATO, the United Nations, these sorts of organizations, he said, we have to all protect those. So that's going to go down very well. Also, his idea that we're in this for the long run, i.e., President Trump is not going to be President Trump forever. It is your responsibility as lawmakers to think beyond that. That also is something that the French like because it has been, 250 years of French-American, very close relations, so they like that. So in terms of the French public, a bit icky at the start, but by the end it was, yes, this is what France stands for.
When you say icky at the start, what do you mean?
The absolute friendliness, yes. The picture that, the photo that got the big uptake here was that one of President Trump leading President Macron by the hand, almost looking like he was his dog that he was leaning out to. And also the pictures of President Trump where it seemed to be that he was brushing dandruff off the president's lapel is not something that goes down well here.
Well, a lot of people have called him the Trump whisperer, that somehow he has a way to deal with President Trump who can be difficult that other leaders have not been able to do. I guess it'll say a lot when all is said and done and he's back home to see if he was able to change the president's minds regarding the Iran nuclear deal or the Paris Climate Agreement or any other issue that they were talking about.
Indeed. In fact, Emmanuel Macron is going to have to put a bit of a spin on his whole trip when he's on the plane coming back home, because just a few hours after he mentioned to Congress this new idea of the Iran deal with these four new pillars that need to be looked at, the foreign policy chief of the European Union, Federica Mogherini, came out and she said, no, we are sticking with this agreement. The JCPOA is an agreement we're sticking to. We like it. The Iranians like it. We are not renegotiating. So in a way, Emmanuel Macron has gone rogue almost from his European partners because he was going there not just as French president, but also as the representative of the European Union. And no one really expected nor wanted him to ditch or talk about ditching that Iran deal. So he's got a lot to make up there also look at the other key aspects. He didn't get any agreement when it came to tariffs for steel. That was another thing European steel manufacturers were really keen on getting an answer to. Also on climate, he was talking about this need for multilateral approach, need for the Paris Climate Accord, but he didn't hear any positive words back. So he's going to have to work on selling that to not just his own public, but to the European Union partners as well.
This friendship that we have been witnessing, do you think that this is strategic on Macron's part, or do you think he actually really, as opposite as they are, has some sort of connection with the president?
He was asked about this just over a week ago in a television interview that President Macron made, and he was asked this relationship that he has with Donald Trump, and he defended it, and he said, I have to talk to Donald Trump. He said that's one of the, if you like, the basis of French diplomacy, the French exception, if you like, that you have to talk to everyone, and he said, I have to talk to him. Like it or not, he is the American president, and if we don't talk to him, then we're not going to get anywhere. So you know, it's difficult to say whether this is a real friendship or if he's just being the French president and needing to have allies for the country who elected him president. At the same time, there is also a bit of a worry that is Emmanuel Macron going to be seduced by the American president in the same way that then British Prime Minister Tony Blair was with George W. Bush and when he followed him into Iraq? There is that concern, yes, that it might tip over. But given what Emmanuel Macron has said so far, it seems to be strategic. And he also said in that interview 10 days ago that he doesn't have friends. He just has interests. And the interest at the front of his mind is always France and what can he do for France.
All right, Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. And as you might expect, there's been a lot of talk on social media about Macron's speech to Congress. Doug Bernard has that part of the story.
Lots and lots of people were listening, not just in the United States, but really around the world. And his comments have generated a tremendous amount of buzz and discussion. Lots of people liking what they heard. Of course, not everybody. Let's just take a quick little look here. Somebody who calls themselves School Sister writes, Macron is absolutely making a fool of everything 45, that referring to President Trump, the 45th U.S. president, has done and said for more than 2 years. And it is beautiful. Hashtag Macron, which is the hashtag that's trending. I miss having an educated leader who cares more about himself than dollars. Randy has this to say, close your eyes. We are listening to a new, fresh version of our beloved President Obama. This speech is giving me strength and hope for our world. The leader of the free world stands before us. Peter Finnegan writes, it's nice to see an articulate president with an understanding of world politics and economics and a vision for how to move forward, addressing both houses of the U.S. Congress. It's been a couple of years. And Walter Gottlieb writes, Macron, hashtag Macron, delivers stunning rebuke of Trumpism in speech to Congress. And he uses this quote, quote, we can use isolation, withdrawal, and nationalism as a temporary remedy to our fears, but it will not douse but inflame our fears. And Brother K has this to say, I've never heard of this Senator Macron before, but he's got my vote for president in 2020. Of course, not everybody is happy. A number of Republicans or Trump supporters feel that President Macron has gone a little too far afield in his criticisms of U.S. policy and connected with that, at least in a tangential way, President Trump, especially given the warm welcome that he has received here. But by and large, lots of people warmly welcoming President Macron's address and his comments.
All right, Doug, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. is probing alleged atrocities against Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims. Tennessee, a Tennessee town on edge after a workplace immigration raid. The World Bank disputes a U.S. audit of Afghan reconstruction program. And Kenya, the economy seen rebounding after the election showdown. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, after an intense oral argument over the president's travel ban Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court is scheduled to rule in June whether or not to execute an order exceeding the executive order exceeded the authority the president has over immigration. The challengers in Trump v. Hawaii have said that Congress created a system of laws that address the security concerns the president addressed in his executive order limiting travel from certain majority Muslim countries. The U.S. Solicitor General Noel Francisco told the justices that the president is well within his power to issue the proclamation. Joining us now to discuss is immigration attorney Navide Zaad. So what was the premise of this hearing before the nation's highest court?
The question really in this Supreme Court case is twofold. One is, has the president overstepped its constitutional powers? And second is, whether there's a unconstitutional religious discrimination, which would be, again, a violation of the Constitution.
When you say religion, is that related to previous comments the president made during the campaign about Muslims, or is it just because these are predominantly Muslim countries we're dealing with?
Both. The first one you mentioned is a very interesting and novel issue for the court. The government is arguing that the remarks on the campaign trail should not matter. You know, the state of Hawaii argues, and I think quite convincingly, that you have a man here who had made specific comments in relation to his presidency, leading up to his presidency, saying, if you elect me for president, I will shut down Muslims from entering the United States. As soon as he got into office, he put not just one, but three different versions of this travel ban to do just that. His actions speak for itself. You also have this travel ban that impacts 98% of the people that are impacted by this travel ban are Muslim. And I'll also just add that think of it as a reasonable person. You have someone on a campaign trail making these statements, then following up with a travel ban. It just is fishy. I don't think we can turn a blind eye to that.
What kinds of arguments did the White House make or the Trump administration make for the travel ban to stay in place?
The government's main argument rests on national security, and it is a strong argument. There is precedent for the president to have broad authority when it comes to national security and emergencies. However, the issue at point here is neither an emergency nor necessarily a national security issue. What you have here is a president making a very broad blanket ban of a whole category of people without a specific assessment of that individual applicant. It's also not an emergency. The government has based its choosing of these countries on whether that country has a good system of sharing information with the United States in vetting these people. Purportedly, that's logical and it makes sense. On the other hand, it leaves a lot of leeway for the president to pick and choose which countries it wants to include in the ban and which countries not to include in the ban.
It looks like the decision is not going to come down for a bit, several months, I think. Was there any indication from the justices as to which way they might be leaning?
We have a court where the majority are conservative. There's no question that the conservative-leaning justices did not want to clip the wings of the president and his powers. And I can understand the basis for that, because this case will have far-reaching ramifications, not just for this president, but we want to be mindful of how we limit the powers of the president in the future. At the same time, this case is very significant because I think it's a true test of our moral compass. Sadly, this travel ban is reminiscent of the ships of refugees who were turned away at Ellis Island during World War II, leading instead to their deaths in the concentration camp. And when we reflect on these moments in our history, most of us recognize the immorality. But here we are in the midst of a very similar dilemma. But I think this is really the test where we get to show as America that we're not going to let our moral compass falter.
All right. Immigration attorney Navide Zaad, thanks for being with us. Well, the stakes will be high on Friday for the third ever inter-Korean summit, when North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in sit down on the southern side of the world's most heavily armed border. There is cautious optimism among world leaders whether Kim will abandon his country's nuclear weapons. Until a few months ago, there were real fears of war. The fate of a planned Trump-Kim meeting, possibly next month, is also seen as being linked to what happens Friday. On Tuesday, President Trump talked about his upcoming meeting with Kim.
We have been told directly that they would like to have the meeting as soon as possible. And we think that's a great thing for the world. That's a great thing for North Korea and South Korea and Japan and France and everybody. So we're having very, very good discussions.
Well, James Kim, research fellow at the Asian Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul, talks to VOA's Victor Beatty about the mood in South Korea ahead of this historic meeting.
I think it's split among conservatives who are weary of possible acceptance by President Moon of a deal that is not good for South Korea. So there's some concern there. On the other hand, overall, everyone is cautiously optimistic, or some people are expecting a very positive outcome as a result of the talks, which will occur on the 27th.
What do you think the topic of those talks will be?
Clearly, the North Korean nuclear issue is one that President Moon has said that he will talk about with the North Korean counterpart, Kim Jong-un. He has also expressed an interest in working towards some kind of a peace regime or an arrangement that will allow for the eventual signing of a peace treaty, which we don't have on the Korean Peninsula at the moment. And finally, to find areas of cooperation with North Korea to expand engagement with Pyongyang.
This is the third such summit of its kind. Is there an expectation of a different outcome than the previous two summits?
Among experts who have followed North Korea, there is deep skepticism that we will get a different kind of an outcome. And when I say outcome here, I mean denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. But again, we haven't had these two particular leaders ever meet before. It's been over 10 years since last meeting in 2007, and this is a meeting that North Korea has been requesting for some time now. It's one that I think a lot of people are hopeful about. Clearly, President Moon is very much interested. He's the first one to have reached out, but the North Koreans have also expressed an interest in talks. So there's some optimism there, but on the other hand, in general, I think the experts are somewhat skeptical, and they're being very cautious about the meeting.
Will this set the tone for any possible U.S.-North Korean encounter?
Clearly, yes, because White House will be able to use this particular meeting as a reference point to gather information about what to expect in the next meeting in June. Clearly, confirmation from the South Koreans about the North Korean resolve and commitment to denuclearization will go a long way towards making that June meeting actually happen and also making it successful. So this is a very important meeting in the sense that it will set the mood and it will allow the Trump administration to have a window at what the North Korean thinking is as it moves into the June meeting.
UN Special Rapporteur Thomas Ojeda Quintana has urged South Korea to bring up the issue of human rights when Mr. Moon meets Kim Jong-un. Will that be on the agenda?
Clearly, this is a concern for President Moon, given how much he has worked on this particular issue even before his political career had started as a lawyer. So this is an issue that President Moon cares very deeply about personally. But I'm not sure at the moment whether this issue will be raised at the talks. It will be an issue for which the North and South may not see eye to eye on. And the question is whether President Moon will have the courage to raise this issue and potentially risk the positive outcome that may result from the summit.
That's James Kim, research fellow at the Asian Institute for Policy Studies in South Korea. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Israel has abandoned a plan to deport thousands of African migrants. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
About 37,000 African migrants have gotten a reprieve after Israel canceled deportation orders that had left the community in limbo. In February, the government handed out papers to thousands of African males, which amounted to an ultimatum: leave the country in 2 months or go to prison. The plan was abandoned when Rwanda backed out of a deal to take the migrants in, saying it could not guarantee their safety. In a radio interview, Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan admitted that the government has no solution for the problem of the infiltrators, as they are called here. He blamed Israel's Supreme Court and human rights groups, which warned that forcibly deporting the migrants back to Africa would endanger their lives. Most of the Africans came from war-torn Eritrea and Sudan and entered Israel illegally over the past decade. Teklit Mikhael, who came from Eritrea, breathed a sigh of relief.
I'm very happy to see the deportation policy is cancelled, and now it is the right time for the Israeli government to give a solution for the asylum seekers who came from Africa, a refugee status, or to answer their asylum claim application.
But the Israeli government rejects the Africans' claim they are refugees, with this legislator describing it as a lie.
זה השקר, זה הקמפיין הכי שקרי שיש היום בתקשורת. פליטים, מדינת ישראל קולטת, ואני אלחם
שנקלוט פליטים. יואב קיש of the ruling right-wing Likud party said they are economic migrants seeking to escape poverty in Africa, and therefore Israel is not obligated to take them in. Officials blame the Africans for rising crime in southern Tel Aviv and accuse them of damaging the Jewish character of the state. So the government is looking for new ways to pressure them to leave voluntarily. But many Israelis are sympathetic toward the migrants. They say Israel has a moral responsibility to offer them asylum because the country was built by Jewish refugees fleeing the Holocaust. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Well, the White House is rejecting accusations President Donald Trump and his administration are hampering freedom of the press in the United States. A media watchdog and advocacy group has dropped the United States 2 places to 45th in the world in its annual press freedom rankings. It blamed the president's repeated verbal attacks on reporters, publications, and TV news networks as a cause. VOA's Mil Arcega reports for Masood Farivar.
Until just a few years ago, Western democracies were seen as a beacon of press freedom. But that's changed in recent years, thanks to the emergence of populist leaders that critics see as hostile to the media. Freedom House and Reporters Without Borders say press attacks by leaders such as U.S. President Donald Trump and right-wing French politician Marine Le Pen pose an increasing threat to democracy. And they say the hostile attitude towards the press is spilling over beyond the borders of Western nations, encouraging authoritarian regimes to crack down on media. In its report, Freedom House warns that populist leaders constitute a major threat to free expression in open societies. Sarah Rapucci is with Freedom House in Washington.
Authoritarian leaders will call out and say, well, Trump criticizes the media. What we're doing is no different.
Reporters Without Borders offers a strikingly similar assessment, warning that more and more democratically elected leaders no longer see the media as part of democracy's essential underpinnings, but as an adversary to which they openly display their aversion. Margot Ewan is the group's North America director.
Hatred of journalism is increasingly threatening democracies around the world, and political leaders in democracies but also in authoritarian regimes are attempting to export their vision of journalism in other countries where it may have been better protected in the past.
Trump came in for harsh criticism from both organizations. Reporters Without Borders called him a media bashing enthusiast, while Press Freedom warned that Trump's characterization of the media as the enemy of the American people, as well as his disparagement of journalists and media organizations, have undermined public trust in fact-based journalism. Again, Sarah Ripucci of Freedom House.
The United States is the one that we're watching most closely. It's a country that has huge importance as a model for press freedom for other countries around the world, and it's a country where Trump's attacks on the press have been of great concern.
Reporters Without Borders, which evaluates the level of press freedom in 180 countries and ranks them on a scale of 1 to 180, with 1 being the freest, downgraded the United States 2 places to 45th. Norway replaced Finland for the number 1 spot, while North Korea remained at the bottom at 180. But it wasn't all gloom. There were some bright spots in Africa where several authoritarian leaders have left office. Among them, Gambia, where a new president has promised a less restrictive press law jumped 21 places, Africa's biggest. For Masood Farivar, Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Intellectual property is a term that refers to unique creations of the human mind that are subsequently recognized and protected by law, such as inventions, literary and artistic works, as well as symbols, names, images, and designs used in commerce. It includes musical performances, films, fashion, advances in technology or medicine, and innovations on existing design in every field and genre. Simply put, intellectual property represents our genius. Stealing intellectual property is no less of a crime than stealing someone's wallet or damaging their sale goods. Some consequences of intellectual property theft are obvious. If a patient is treated with counterfeit medication, his or her health could suffer, or they could die. Intellectual property theft deprives artists, inventors, and innovators of their just compensation and cheats purchasers of pirated goods because the value of the purchase is less than advertised. Some of the lesser-known forms of intellectual property theft include appropriation of trade secrets and specialized know-how, usually through cyber theft, and compulsory transfer of technology from transnational companies to the government of a country on whose territory they wish to conduct business. Still, one of the most serious consequences of intellectual property theft is that it stifles creativity and innovation. Why dedicate effort and resources to creation or innovation if one is not likely to reap commensurate rewards? On April 26th, we observe World Intellectual Property Day to celebrate creativity, to acknowledge the contributions of creators, inventors, and innovators to the development of societies across the globe, and to raise awareness of how patents, copyright, and trademarks contribute to humanity's progress. This year's theme, Women in Innovation and Creativity, is designed to celebrate women's contributions to intellectual property. The protection and enforcement of intellectual property rights help ensure the world will continue to benefit from the time, resources, and brain power invested in developing new technologies and improvement of existing ones, from the works of some of our most creative citizens, and from new brands and modes of production. On this day, as we celebrate the human capacity to create, innovate, and invent, we call on all our friends and partners to stiffen intellectual property laws where needed and enforce them strictly for the sake of us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.